So there is no supernatural entity?
There are no supernatural causes of natural events.
So we thought we'd take a different tack this Sunday. Rather than giving you evidence for supernatural, the supernatural, what we would do is give you a way of answering the best arguments for supernaturalism, or for naturalism. So if a naturalist comes to you, or you talk to somebody and they say, I don't believe in the supernatural, I don't believe in anything beyond matter, energy, space, and time, the universe is all there is, all there was, and all there ever will be kind of thing, how do you answer it? Hang on, Dan. Let me finish my intro. And then what we want you to be able to do is ask them the question, why do you believe that? Because in the end, the reasons are pretty weak. So what we want to do is take, Mark and I worked up a list this week, take some of these responses one at a time, and we're going to let you guys start. Okay, you guys open it up. How does a Christian respond to these statements about why naturalism is true? Which, of course, we don't believe, but how do you respond to it? So, you want to say anything?
Just remember that when you're coming up with your answer, envision the person that you're talking to, and so that you're not coming up merely with a cognitive argument, even though a cognitive argument would be important, but also conceive of what they might be, what would be their follow-up question or follow-up response. And then if, as this discussion goes, when it seems to get exhausted, then Ross and I will have something to say about it too.
There we go, let's go. Okay, this thing gets stuck at the worst times. 2, 3, 4, 5. Reasons to believe in naturalism. The first one, we cannot do science in a supernatural world. Naturalism must be assumed. How would you respond to that? Wait for the mic. Peter?
How can you be claiming science if you're claiming assumption? How would you claim other than observation as a scientific proposition instead of assumption?
I'm not clear on what you mean.
Yeah, I'm not clear what you're saying there. Help us out. So let me pretend I'm the naturalist, and I'm going to say, well, we can't do science in a supernatural world. We just have to have, naturalism has to be true.
That's an assumption. So how are you an open mind if you're making assumption and claiming that you must follow a dogma? Aren't you in fact being religious?
Well, let's say I am being religious. You can leave the microphone with him because I think we're probably going to have a chat.
Well, good. I get to argue with you.
Yeah, so as a naturalist, I would say, let's say it is an assumption, and let's say, but let's say it's not a religion, because I don't believe in any God or hold to anything like that. And if you're arguing that I'm having a dogma, that I'm holding something in a dogmatic way, as a naturalist, I'm going to say, of course I am.
Well, then you're following an ism.
No, an ism is an ideology.
You have an ideology. Don't deny it.
Well, okay. Well, maybe I have two of them.
Don't feel attacked.
I don't feel attacked. I'm not reaching for my coffee to throw it out. But as a naturalist, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to have some ground foundations. All of us do. You can't live in the world without them, which is more evidence for naturalism, that we naturally will go towards natural causes for natural events because we can't live without that. So if you Christians are going to come up with a supernaturalism for trying to explain the natural causes, then you're wasting our time. You're putting us back before the Dark Ages. Come on.
I would remind you of two things.
Please.
One is that the most significant contributions to discovery of understanding the universe were made by believers such as Newton. Even Darwin had some component of faith to his worldview. And secondly, there are a number of significant questions, and the point is to lay all the evidence on the table and look at what logical conclusions follow from the inference of that evidence. So if you start out with an assumption on such a topic, then you're never going to see evidence that could challenge you. So in some sense, your wall of disbelief doesn't serve you, because you could have evidence that would enrich your worldview, but if you put up a wall in front of what could challenge your worldview, you only cheat yourself. And Christians, if you're going to say Christians aren't open to evidence, that's simply a lie. You don't know Christians then.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know a lot of Christians, but as a naturalist, I don't really need to know Christians, because there's a lot of non-Christians who are doing really great work as naturalists. And so really, you can do very good science as a naturalist, have assumptions, which everybody has to have. You're going to have to assume that the ground we're walking on is solid and it's not going to suddenly open up and eat you. We have to assume that you're going to continue breathing, that the sun's going to rise tomorrow, etc. So we all have assumptions. As a naturalist, I'm not in any peculiar position that you aren't in. And so I think we're on an equal footing there. I think as a naturalist, what we would have to say is that we naturalists rely on what we see. And I know you Christians think that there's evidence for what you believe, but ultimately even your evidence is a naturalist position, because you're looking at natural causes for natural events.
Well, that's not really a true statement, though.
No.
I'd ask you to consider a statement made by Jordan Peterson when he was challenged to say, I don't see the person challenging him said, your ideology doesn't seem consistent to me, because on one hand you do this and on the other hand you do that. And his response was, you don't need an ideology. And I'd ask you to look at life from that statement's point of view. You don't need an ideology. You need to be free.
Well, that's ridiculous, because everybody has an ideology. Everybody does. One way or the other, everyone has an ideology. And an ideology is a complex of beliefs that forms a view towards a subject or a worldview. And no matter what, an ideology usually is captured in the way we use language in English with an ISM at the end of the word. So naturalism, empiricism, all of these kinds of isms, those are ideologies, because we're taking a particular perspective on some aspect of the world. And then we make assumptions, but we also include, what does it take to count as true? What does it take to count as within the boundaries of that discipline, et cetera? So we all have ideologies. They're not necessarily equivalent. Some ideologies make sense. Some of them aren't coherent. So whoever, I forget, was it Jordan Peterson that said you don't have ideologies? Or I'm not sure who was taking what position there, but everyone has an ideology. Just depends on where it's going to go.
I have trouble with the question, because I've never heard it asked this way. And if a science-oriented person were to ask it this way, it seems to be self-refuting. It implies that if a supernatural world exists, we can't know about it. So it allows for the existence of supernaturalism, is what I'm trying to say. But I've just never heard the question asked this way. We cannot do science in a supernatural, it's not a question actually, but we can't do science in a supernatural world. We have to assume naturalism. So that begs the question, well, what if the world is supernatural?
Very good.
I'm shooting myself in the foot if I say it this way. That's why I've never heard it said this way.
So if there is a supernatural component to the world, would it be true that we can't do science?
That's reasonable.
I'm asking it. Somebody said it.
No.
You're saying that's not true?
I'm thinking you can still do science in a supernatural world. Science is, it's a form, it's a procedure, right? You do, you test something, you have a test group, a control group, you can prove it. I mean, naturalism doesn't have to be assumed.
So I think you're onto something. There's no reason we can't test predictable things in a universe that is mostly predictable, even if there's a supernatural component to it. But let's go back one more step. Many scientists today say that invoking any supernatural cause is not science. So they're excluding it definitionally. Is that a reasonable thing to say? It can't be science if it invokes the supernatural. Okay, yeah, Christy, go ahead.
Well, just semantically, supernatural is a little bit beyond natural and kind of includes natural. So if we are in a supernatural world or even a natural world, the design of the natural world might be beyond us, but it's still, it's actually, I would argue it's natural. I saw a film yesterday at the Natural History Museum, yesterday actually, in San Diego, and they were talking about flight and how nature, you know, how the first creatures and then, you know, up through the pterodactyls to the birds. And basically it was a history of natural flight. But they kept saying, and then nature did this, and then nature did that. And these were scientists, and I'm sure it was edited by scientists, and they kept, so they personified nature. So if they're personifying nature, there's something in them or you that I would say acknowledges the supernatural.
Yeah. Good. So.
Yeah, for one thing, they have to do a lot of testing, though.
Yes, they do.
She's right about one thing. They have to do a lot of testing, though.
Thank you. Dean?
Yeah, I would try to work from the from some of the definitions that the scientists are giving us. Because it can speed up a lot of time. So they say, okay, yeah, for science, let's just do the data-driven work that you guys have been diligently doing for 500 years, and that's science. And then I have my religion, and there's certain things that drive things in my life, and that's the supernatural world. So it might be a step to forming a bond with people who are more scientific-driven and work in science to say, yeah, okay, your world of science, there's nothing supernatural per se in what you guys are doing. Even though, you know, as a Christian, I believe there's a God who definitely brought all this stuff into creation and is guiding it along the whole way, but he also allows for this discipline, science, that's data-driven. So I would try to work with their definitions and then go from there.
Okay. So hey, welcome.
Hello. I think so this conclusion, naturalism must be assumed, is based on the premise we cannot do science in a supernatural world. I think you have to deconstruct that premise because science, the discipline of science, it quantifies material things and the causal relations between them. It's a closed system. So every effect has an antecedent cause.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the assumption being here with supernaturalism is that because science only deals with material things, if we introduce supernatural causes that exist outside of a closed material system, science is no longer able to quantify those causes. So I think they're saying the very nature of supernaturalism, it extends beyond the boundaries of science as a discipline. So if we're introducing those supernatural causes, science fails to explain what those might be.
And yet somebody like Isaac Newton or Descartes would have said there are supernatural causes for some of these events that we are seeing. They would not have had any trouble with the idea that science can include the supernatural. So how would you respond to this if someone who was not a believer, who was a naturalist, came to you and said something similar to this, and you wanted to get them to see that maybe there's another way to look at it, how would you respond to it?
I like Bill Craig's response to Peter Atkins, because he made the assumption that science itself can explain all things. And what he did was he identified the discipline of science itself, making certain assumptions that are not quantifiable by science.
Right, that statement included.
Exactly. So to, I think, identify the point of contradiction where science itself makes certain assumptions that it cannot verify. They're merely assumed. So, I mean, maybe giving some practical examples to that might be a good starting point.
And would the assumption of naturalism be one of those?
Certainly.
Yeah.
I think Lewis and Alvin Plantinga, the evolutionary argument against naturalism, is a good place to start as well. Just looking at the nature of consciousness, mm-hmm. how that is inexplainable as a product of evolution. So,
very good. Yeah, Dan?
Yes, I tell this statement to my boss. He's an atheist. And I said, the universe, scientifically speaking, you can find out thousands, maybe even millions of information that was put in by design, intelligent design. That's why we can predict when some comet is going to come by. Everything is explained in the universe, scientifically speaking. But it is. Somebody put that information in there. So I asked my boss, who put that information? You know, I said, everything that we have in this world, computers, airplanes, everything is intelligent design. Somebody put that information there. And there is more intelligence in the air universe than in science here in the Earth. That's how I tell them, somebody put that information, you can call it whatever you want. Einstein, I think, mentioned a force or something, but somebody put that information. And when I ask him, he says, tell me who put that information in there. And so he cannot answer, and I say, I tell you, God put that information in there.
I think you're onto something, Dan. I think for me, one of the greatest arguments for the supernatural, for a creator, is the existence of information in the universe, and especially in the DNA. Information ultimately always originates from a mind. And the code in the DNA in first life is so fantastically complex that a conscious creator is the best explanation for that code. We're off on another. Yes, go ahead.
So, what would you, as a naturalist, say to the scientifically proven fact that the universe, time, energy, space, and matter were created or came into existence from nothing? Isn't this the ultimate observance of the supernatural?
Go ahead.
I think that's right. Yeah, the question or the answer was, whatever, I don't know whether, I think it's a question and an answer at the same time, but how would a naturalist explain the origin of the universe, the origin of space, time, matter, and energy from nothing? To get something from nothing is by definition supernatural. Am I getting you right?
Exactly.
Yes, thank you. And I think that's that's on to something, because the effectiveness of that forces the scientist or the naturalist to come up with a natural explanation for something that is clearly, by definition, can't be natural. Because if it were, then it would have another cause, and you'd end up with an infinite regress. And we're not in a position right now to talk about the arguments against the infinite regress. There are some interesting arguments against it and for it. I think the ones for it are deficient, but let's just leave it at that. So what this shows is that science is going to bump into things. Naturalist science is going to bump into things that they cannot explain by the tools of science itself. And you end up with that, particularly in, say, the origin of the universe, where they start to talk about multiverses. All right, how do they come up with that? Do they have some kind of empirical data that says, well, here's some evidence of the other universe? And no, they don't, because by definition, they couldn't have access to the other universe, or it'd be part of our universe. So the scientist, the naturalist scientist, is going to bump into those boundaries. And this is where it becomes really interesting, because scientists will masquerade, they'll have metaphysics masquerading as science, and people won't know it.
Can you give an example of that, Mark?
The example of that is the multiverse. That is a metaphysical assumption, because there is not one tiny little microscopic fragment of empirical evidence, which is what naturalism requires. Mm-hmm. Empirical means something that you can actually work with and people can replicate, or at least in principle. And in this case, they don't have any. So they're making a metaphysical assumption. Or you could look at, say, the many worlds interpretation, one of the many worlds interpretations of quantum physics. Exactly the same thing. They have no idea. What the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics is that, for example, we don't know when any given, neutron or proton, whatever it is, let's say proton, is going to decay and split off into other particles. We just know that in mass, in aggregate, on the average, it's going to take a certain amount of time for, say, uranium to decompose into lead. So how do you explain that? You don't know what the time difference is between the shortest decay rate and the longest decay rate is. How do you explain that from one to the other? We can't. And so one of the explanations is, well, obviously what's happening is one of them is in one world, a parallel universe, and another one's in the other universe. That's whack. Okay, how do you get that?
It's so pretty convenient, isn't
it? It's very convenient. And I was reading an article, and it was a physicist who actually was doing the research on this kind of decay rates. Says, you know, theoretical physicists are really good at dodging the traps that empirical experimental physicists lay for them. So in other words, if I come up with empirical evidence that makes it very difficult for you to hold your theory, you just move your theory around a little bit and make it more vague, or make it more impossible for me to access empirically, which gets us back to the point. If I can't access it empirically, then it's by definition supernatural. And I mean empirical in principle, that some observation could do it. Neither one of those two, at a quantum level or at the cosmic level, is going to allow us to get access to those things, and they are metaphysical. So we are doing science in a supernatural world, if you want to call it that, because if we're calling all of existence the world, then it is at once natural and supernatural.
Right. Very good. I want to say this one thing. I was going to keep it for the end, but it fits right in with what you're saying. And I'll probably do it at the end anyway. Because I have a way, I think, of thinking about this, of saying this, that every single one of you in this room can put, no matter what your level of education or science education is, can put the other person on the defensive with. And this is it. And I should have typed it up and put it on the PowerPoint, but I didn't, so you got to remember it. Simply ask them, because much of this goes to origins. If there is a supernatural world, it's assumed that the supernatural world pre-existed the natural world. Does a naturalistic explanation better explain what we see in the world around us? In other words, no mind, no person in the case of God? Or does mind, being the very first thing in existence, better explain what we see in the world? It sure looks like the natural world has a whole lot of things in it that look designed. Even Richard Dawkins would admit that it looks designed. So what is just the most logical way to explain things? That there was no mind, only matter, we started with that and everything came from that? Or does it look designed? Does it look like mind came first and preceded matter? Now, a naturalist will say, well, it may look that way, but it isn't. Well, you say, well, why isn't it? It sure looks that way. Aren't we looking at evidence here? What does the evidence give us? Doesn't the evidence give us this idea of conscious choices being made, conscious design being made? I think that's a way to think about it that everybody here can understand. Does that, what do you think of that?
I think that's great, and I think if you go to number two, that's, it's going to be implied in number two.
Let's go to number two then. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, if you take science seriously, and I'm not quite sure what that means, but let's just pretend it means it in a naive sense, it automatically leads to naturalism. And what you're saying is it only automatically leads to naturalism if you assume naturalism.
Yes, if you go in with that bias.
That's right. So if I go in and I start looking for causes, I can do it two ways. I can say, I don't know what caused this, and so it's a mystery, and I'm gonna keep probing and using all of the tools at my disposal to find a cause. That's methodological naturalism. That's perfectly appropriate. If I say the only possible explanation can be a natural cause, then that's metaphysical, philosophical naturalism. So methodological naturalism. And we have to be careful that we're not slipping into a bias to saying it can only be a natural cause. But on the other hand, the naturalist has good reason to do that. The naturalist has very good reason to say we're only going to look for natural causes. We're not going to allow us to slip in God and say, well, God did this one, but you know, we got the cause on this one, but that problem's solved because God did it. So if that's the case, then where do we draw the line? Where do we say we're not going to look for natural causes, that this is a supernatural event? Where do we do that? That's an interesting question, but the answer to the question here is if you take science seriously, it automatically leads to naturalism. That proposition is false. It doesn't automatically lead to naturalism. It can, and it probably should in most cases. But I guess if I had a naturalist saying that to me, I would ask some questions, but I see some other people with their hands up, so I'd like you to get involved.
Christy?
I would be curious to ask them, if you take that approach of, I'm looking at everything through a natural lens, would you have a reason why the Bible, who they would say was written way later than the beginning of the earth because people weren't around yet, but way before the advances of science, how would it get so much accurate, like the expansion of the universe or the even scientists agree on the order of which things happen, even if they don't look at it in 24-hour days, but how would it get so much right before science discovery of empirical evidence caught up to it? Would they have a reason for that?
So I understand your argument to be basically that some parts of the Bible are very accurate descriptions of the origin of the world and its evolution, not in an evolutionary way, but the way that it came to be.
Yeah. Things are verifiable now by scientists long before science caught up to it. That's what I should have said.
Sure. If I were a naturalist and I heard that, I would use the same line of reasoning that, let's say, somebody like Michael Shermer uses. He says, well, you guys are just backing into it. In other words, we have very clear explanations of events. So for the evolutionist, for example, the person who believes that all of life evolved as a descent from some last common universal ancestor, or a couple or more last universal common ancestors. And because we now know the facts, that you can just superimpose your interpretation of the Bible that's most convenient to fit those facts. And then in fact, the people who actually wrote those verses had no idea that they were going to talk about evolution, or they were going to talk about the progress in detail of the natural world. So Michael Shermer or somebody like him might say something like, you talk about the stretching out of the heavens. Well, that's not what they meant when they wrote that. They didn't mean the expansion of the universe. They had no concept of that. So it's not really a scientific prediction. It's just a locution used by people in the ancient world that we're now backing it into our knowledge of science.
That's an ignorant statement because he doesn't
know. Use the mic, yeah. Peter.
Yeah. Well, if Michael Shermer says that, Michael Shermer can be challenged on his biblical knowledge, therefore. Are you saying you're an expert on the book that I read all the time? How much do you read it, Michael?
That's a good point.
Well, let's say Michael reads it 24 hours a day, and twice on Sundays.
If he claims that, he's just a liar.
Yeah, he would be. And I don't want to impugn Michael Shermer. What I want to do is, and I may even be misrepresenting him. I've just heard him a lot of times, and this is kind of where he goes with it. And I've actually heard him use the term backing into it.
Use the mic, Peter.
But let's go back to the point, because the point is, and you can keep a hold of the mic, you don't have to give it up yet, okay, that we have to be careful if we're going to use the Bible as a claim that the Bible is a scientific instrument or a scientific way of knowing things, when the people who originally received them did not think of them that way. We have to be careful of that, because the scientist is going to, that's the first thing that a good scientist who also knows the Bible is going to say that. I would. I'd say, well, wait a minute. Tell me how this guy 3,500 years ago is figuring out the expansion of the universe. I don't think Jeremiah even conceived of that. So we have to be capable of shifting our mindsets too. Remember, it's our duty to understand their thinking, not their duty to understand ours. All right, so we have to go into their world and show them that our world is worth coming into. So going into their world and saying, okay, science has all of these interesting empirical facts. Some of them, now that you Christians bring it up to us, okay, yeah, I can see these 6 days of creation actually do match what we know about the way of natural history. Okay, I'll give you that. I, the skeptic, will give you that. But that's not the same thing as being predictive. Everyone in the back.
I want to argue with you for...
Well, they've got to argue with me too, man. And I get to argue over coffee.
But I'm up here, so I get to do it.
Okay.
All right, so real quick, going back to what you said about the biblical authors did not intend X, whatever it is. If we restrict our interpretation of the Bible to what did the original author mean, we're going to miss a lot of stuff. For example, Isaiah, we believe as Christians, Isaiah speaks grandly and eloquently of the Trinity. Yet Isaiah had no concept of the Trinity as we understand. There's a lot of things in the Bible that we understand now about how to interpret it properly that could not have been understood by the original author.
That's true. But there's a difference between, let's say, a scriptural verse that means something at the time it's uttered,
mm-hmm,
and is understood in a particular way at the time it's uttered, and it concomitantly is a prediction, a prophecy. You know, it says something at the instant, and then it says something about the future.
Right.
And you can show that later on. Now, that's one way of doing biblical interpretation, and it's successful. But that's not the same thing as saying it made a statement that was intended to be meant one way, and later on it's meant to be scientific. Mm-hmm. See, the prophecy is built into the scripture as a way of testing the prophet. And if it doesn't come to pass, then it's false, and the prophet should be killed. You know,
yes.
That's the way it goes in the Old Testament. It's a rough life being a prophet. A bad one. So, but is, let's say, Jeremiah and other scriptures that talk about the expansion of the spreading out of the heavens and God's absolute fidelity with the earth, you know, keeping it all the laws of physics together. Is that the same thing, is that the same kind of prophetic utterance as a scientific statement? I don't think they're the same.
Okay.
So that's getting to what I was going to say. I have been told that one elementary tenet of understanding prophecy is that it has multiple meanings, a present meaning, usually, and then a future meaning, perhaps multiple future meanings. And we simply have to wait and see if the future meanings are fulfilled or how they're fulfilled. So. I hear that objection from scientists all the time that, well, those, you know, first century people couldn't possibly know of science. That's just ridiculous. Of course they didn't know about science. But the point is, if what they uttered made sense at the time, and then it had another meaning in the future that exactly fit their words, it's something to pay attention to. It's not conclusive, but you put it together with lots of other similar evidence, and it's very persuasive.
And I think that's really the key, and that's what we have to be careful of, is that it's very easy to telescope down into, or microscope down into, little parts of our ideas rather than going back larger and looking at the totality of the evidence. So what we say is, all right, I'll give you, Mr. Scientist or Mrs. Scientist, that these, let's say the 6 days of creation weren't necessarily, we cannot prove that those were scientifically predictive. We'll give you that. But let me give you the 402,000 other things that suggest that the Bible is accurate and is giving us truths that science does not, or at least that are completely concordant with science. The difference there is now we're stepping back and we're using all of the evidence rather than just one little piece of evidence and trying to die on a hill that it's going to be impossible to survive in any one case.
Recently, I've been studying civilization, and in my studies, art is very significant because when a civilization could not understand something, they would draw it or they would represent it by art, and every civilization has a supernatural component to it. The things that they couldn't understand, they would represent it by something. And if we look at what you, Ross, says about the book of creation is in the natural world, as well as the Bible explains the supernatural world. So there are things that we can't explain in the Bible that happen, but we believe that they happen, and we represent it by words. So I'm just saying that there has to be like one time they believed that the Earth was the center of the universe until they had more discovery. There's things like dark matter that they don't know what it is. So we have to progress our knowledge.
Christy? Well, you're getting a workout with the mic today.
Well, I can use it.
I actually think it's significant that the authors weren't scientists, that science wasn't to that point. And if you look at maybe some of the other books like the Book of Mormon or the Quran or those things, they actually get the science wrong, whereas the Bible, are they lucky? Did they get it right, or is something more going on? I think it's significant that they weren't scientists and that wasn't the story they were telling.
Thank you.
I think if you're going to try to do, you have to be really careful taking pieces out of the Bible, like Mark said, because some of it is, it is pretty vague. You know, what does it mean that God stretched out the universe? Like a tent. But there are a few things that are pretty hard for a naturalist to duck. And, you know, one of the ones I would jump on very first one is the very first verse of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. For 1900 years, science thought that the universe was eternal. Now, in the last 100, 150 years, we realize that there's a beginning, and many scientists resisted the idea that there was a beginning because it sounded too religious and it matched Genesis too closely, and they fought it for decades. Well, that's a hard one to interpret any other way. You know, God created it and it has a beginning. That's a good one. That is pretty predictive. You know, anybody reading that in the third century would have been able to understand it pretty much the same way we understand it. It is not eternal. There is a beginning. We now know that it was that was an anti-scientific statement for many centuries. Jim? Oh, yeah.
Christy and I were kind of nodding in agreement about saying it's a I think it's a wonderful thing that those biblical authors were not scientists, and now our science is corroborating a lot of what they've said. So you're going to have to help me out with this, but it's almost like it's a false dichotomy, right, to break up naturalism and supernaturalism. Am I using the right term? We're creating a division that doesn't need to be?
No, I don't think it's a false dichotomy or a false dilemma.
Okay.
There really is a natural and there really is a supernatural. I don't think those are bad categories.
No.
They're legitimate. I think what you may be after is that because we know that God upholds all things with the word of his power, that nothing that is could be without him, that we blend the two. We just see everything as supernatural because, in fact, it is.
Yeah.
But in the terms as we're using natural and supernatural from the empiricist or the naturalistic or the materialist's viewpoint, and in a naive way, in a way that the ordinary person would conceive of it, there we can really say there is a natural and a supernatural.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to comment on that. I think I used to think about it this way for a long time. Like God created the universe to follow what seemed to be predictable laws, and the universe flows on like that, sort of a deistic approach, and every once in a while God intervenes and does something miraculous. I don't think about it that way anymore. I think God intervenes every moment, all the time, for the history of the universe, and mostly his intervention looks predictable. And once in a while, his intervention looks miraculous. I think that's a better way to think about it because it means God is consciously present, involved, intervening all the time. If God stopped intervening, there would be nothing except God again. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Big Jim.
Thank you. If you take science seriously, we know that there are things that are going on in the universe that are a one-way road.
That are what? It's
a one-way road, like the heat death of the universe.
Uh-huh.
Every time anything happens, when I'm speaking and holding this microphone, some of what I'm doing creates heat. And we can get back some of the energy of heat, like burning coal to generate electricity, but you can never get it all back. There's from the beginning to the end, when there's got to be the heat death of the universe, everything will be heat. And the heat will be just so distributed around the world, around the universe, that it can't do anything else. You have to have a point of energy where you have a greater point here that will flow to someplace else, like one side of the battery in your car to another one. And so it's, how could you have something that's always going on in one direction and yet the universe is eternal? It just doesn't make, it won't fit. Doesn't make sense.
Well, it was believed, the steady state model of the universe was that matter, new matter and energy were coming into existence on a regular basis, and that was what was fueling the universe, and that's how it could be eternal and still not burn out, but that's been disproven. That's how they thought of it. Some scientists thought of it, though.
Well, that sounds supernatural to me.
It sure does, doesn't it?
Now, let's get to this question and then kind of put it to bed, because I think what I'd like to do is say, if I were answering a naturalist who said, if you take science seriously, it automatically leads to naturalism, I'd say, in one sense, you're right, in one sense, you're wrong. In the sense that you're right, we will do science naturalistically, using methodological naturalism, because that's the best way to do a business. You don't think God's intervening in every little thing. Just because I can't figure out how rain happens doesn't mean God's doing it. It just means I haven't got the explanation yet. But then we bump into, what are the boundaries where you bump into things that you cannot explain? And I say that those problems are origins problems. And those are where you have to say, when you don't have evidence, and you don't even in principle know how you would ever find that evidence, now you're walking into supernatural.
Yeah.
The origin of the universe, the problems with quantum physics, the development of these different theories, now you're moving into supernaturalism, and it's not necessarily methodological naturalism.
Origin of life, origin of consciousness, origin of man.
You have one more question over on that side. Oh, go ahead.
And how about finality, happiness? And there's a lot of things people care about that Ross has brought up that they're not even looking for a logical answer, but they want to see that somebody cares about us, not just that they started and created the world, but that they care about it now, and that the end matters and where we're headed. And science has a hard time with talking about the future. So I think there's another area that, hey, you got to give us something there that you can't use your data for. Yes, you can predict, there's a predictive capacity to science, but what does it mean? And what's it for in the end? You know, getting a little farther than just what will happen tomorrow as far as temperature.
Thank you. Ted, did you still have a question?
Well, it's more than...
It's coming.
At this age, this is running.
It's more of an objection that I hear frequently that what Mark said just before, it's, you know, we're all always appealing to the God of the gaps. If we have no explanation for it, and we don't know where we would look for that explanation, then we appeal to God as the explanation. Well, that's how it was with electromagnetism and other things that, you know, Maxwell and so on explained. And 200-300 years before Maxwell, well, God was the answer for these mysterious forces. The lodestone, the compass, the et cetera. So that's an objection I hear, and I really never have a satisfactory response to that.
Here's a satisfactory response, or at least a better response. And the question is, if the ancients appealed to God to answer questions that today we would appeal to science for, then any scientist can say, well, we're just going to do the same thing forever. So anytime you use the term God, that is an appeal of the same sort that the ancients used in unsuccessfully. And I would say, what makes you know that in the future you will continue to have scientific discoveries that will answer questions of origins? So the answer back to them is, yes, in the past, those questions were illegitimately answered with God. But now we can ask the question, if we have something like the origin of the universe, for example, where it is possible that we cannot even in principle access that through any empirical testing, that point is a decision that you, Mr. Scientist or Mrs. Scientist, have to make that is not a scientific decision. So that is not wishful thinking, and that is not inserting God in the gaps. That is taking a point of empirical deficiency and saying, okay, now what do we do with this? Now we're stuck with a metaphysical question. We have just hit one of those boundaries that is unlike anything that's ever been in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. Was that responsive to your question, Ted?
And I want to take a shot at that, Ted. The God of the gaps type argument, invoking God for whatever we don't understand, works both ways, because there's naturalism of the gaps. The scientist is going to say, well, I don't know, I can't answer the origin of life problem, but I'm sure that in the future we will come up with a naturalistic explanation. That is exactly the same kind of thinking as the God of the gaps. So don't let them put you on the defensive. They're doing the very same thing. The fact is, origin of life is an intractable problem. There's one researcher who says there should be a moratorium on the research, because in 60 years they haven't come up with anything. So I would say, you can believe that you will find a naturalistic explanation for it someday, but that is naturalism of the gaps, and it is unwarranted by the evidence. No, we got to get it on the recording.
Oh, okay. That actually addresses really well what I saw in that film at the Natural Science Museum, because they kept personifying nature and saying, then nature did this, then nature did that, then nature did this. And that's what I guess you just addressed it really well. So thank you.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting point that you're making, because we have to be careful that when we hear this kind of semantic shorthand, that we call it out the way you just did. So anytime I hear nature did X, nature did Y, evolution figured out the problem of the fish, and that's why we have amphibians. And so that's a very high bar for them to meet. Okay, please tell me how evolution has this purpose.
Or ability.
Mr. Naturalism, please have at it. Show me how it has purpose. Well, really, it doesn't. Okay, then stop talking like it does. Don't use that language. Because what you're trying to do is insert purpose, the sound of purpose and the feel of purpose, into a process that putatively has none. And it cannot have one. It's because as soon as you impute purpose to it, you impute mind.
That's right.
Now, if you want to give me that, Mr. Evolutionist, I'm happy to work with you there. But we have to call him on that. And so it's really important to be listening carefully to things like personification or purpose language, and then jump on it. Do not let them get away with that, unless it's, you know, just in a show or something like that. You got to let it pass.
Don't stand up in the middle of a movie.
Yeah. Because last time I did that, it didn't do any good. The screen did not scream back at me.
So, in order to have a memory, you have to have a brain. And there are those that say that God is a delusion. It's something that we've thought up. But there are so many people, or thousands of people, who have had near-death or death experiences. I saw one lady who was dead for 10 minutes, and she claims she went somewhere and saw all this in heaven and came back. So how can you explain that if a person's brain is dead? How do they know anything? I mean, the older I get, the more I forget.
Do you know you forgot?
You remember that you forgot?
Yeah. I don't know. There's much of an answer to that. You get into that whole question of what is death? What happens to the brain when you die? Is the brain dead when the heart stops and for a certain amount of time? Clinically, we know that if your brain's turned off, your heart's turned off for an hour, you're not getting oxygen to the brain, you're probably not going to revive. Now, there's at least one case that we know absolutely that's false. And a lot of scientists are saying this is very strange, because an hour without oxygen to the brain is beyond what anybody would ever consider being fatal. And yet we have the person who that happened to not only has good evidence of it, but he himself is a physician. And it happened in Australia. And it's a really interesting case, because this guy is not one who's a fanatic, he's not one who's who lacks the data. He knew he was starting to have problems when he was starting to feel bad. He was diagnosing himself as going into the heart attack. And so he was able to get to places and realized, and he had times for everything that happened. So he went here, and of course the clock starts on this instrument and that instrument. And so the bottom line is, it's a unique case that you have all of the empirical data that everybody's always wished they could have. It's not just somebody says, well, I was dead for an hour and I came back, and you know, it was really strange out there. He has the proof. And he has other doctors and clinicians, et cetera, who were there, who were in attendance, who said this should not have happened. And yet afterwards, he has a lot to say about it. My point is, that's a really open question. And I don't know what to make of it. Ross talked about this before. You don't know what to make of it either, except that you believe that it does suggest a supernatural.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, I personally don't see how it could suggest something other. I think it's a powerful piece of evidence. When there are many cases of near-death experiences where, as part of the near-death experience, people see and experience things that are part of the real world. They're not just having a dream or something. They float out of their body, and they're able, for example, to read one of the instruments that is in the operating room while they were being operated on, and then they are revived, and they're able to recount the experience that matched reality. So to a skeptic, I would say it sure looks like their body was here, and their soul, which you don't believe in, was over here. And I would say, if you don't believe that, then the photons of light that were bouncing off the instrument that he claims to have read and went over here, you know, 50 feet away, or however far away it was, what was perceiving that photon? What was perceiving the light coming off of that, which he then recounted when the spirit went back in his body? I don't see any other way to interpret that that's reasonable, other than there was a body that was separate from some experiential entity, which we would call a soul, which then recombined again after, at some point. I think that's a tough one to argue around if you're a naturalist.
Amen.
So the claim that was going on 2,000 years ago is still going on today, isn't it?
To wit?
People coming back from the dead.
Oh, well, Jesus came back from the dead in a completely different form.
And so, and Lazarus?
These aren't resurrections of the type of Jesus. And if you're going to talk about Lazarus or the others who were risen after Christ rose, I think you're right.
Nothing new under the sun.
I want to say one more thing about resurrections, and then we'll go to Lee back there. I brought this book to class a few months ago, but I want to recommend it again. It's actually a two-volume set because it's 1,100 pages, and it's called Miracles by the New Testament scholar Craig Keener. And he goes into all kinds of philosophical arguments against naturalism and why these kinds of things can actually happen. But the most compelling part of the book is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples of miracles that are as well documented as they can be, considering the fact that these things happen in real life. And I think a naturalist, if he looked at this book, would have to just say every single one of these was made up. It's really compelling when you see them all, one after the other, with dates and what happened, and witnesses and places, and as much specificity as you can possibly get. It's really, really remarkable. I spent, I think it's like $30 for the set, but it's worth having just to show somebody, look at this. Did this guy entirely make this stuff up? Or is there probably something to this? Miracles, Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R, if you want to look into it. He's got some great YouTube videos about it too. K-E-E-N-E-R, Keener. Lee.
Okay, thank you. When I engage people, whether it's political or religious, I have to kind of wonder, are they smarter than me? So I'm going to say they are. And they definitely know more than I do, even though most of it's wrong. That's my presumption. When I read the first two statements in number one and this statement, it brings me to my junior high school mentality. Who says and why? And I'm not going to go on the defensive. I'm going to keep asking questions. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you'll see a little light bulb appear on top of their head, and then you can get down to a good discussion.
Yeah. The third question that could be part of that is, what do you mean by that, whatever the word is. Make sure your definitions, like we're talking about science. You know, science 150 years ago was different than science today. There's so many definitional things that we need to keep straight. You want to go to the next one, Mark?
Why not?
We only have, what, 13? And we've done two? Think we'll get through it?
By next week, yeah.
Natural science is the most reliable way to learn about the world. Therefore, naturalism must be true. How would you argue that? Kind of similar to the last one.
You have one in the back.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the first part of that statement I would believe in. What was your second part? I won't address it.
Does it logically follow?
Okay. The thing is, I think it does. And in this case, I may say a couple things. What's been discovered, the Bible has said first. But I wouldn't go into a whole lot of detail because I want them to be answering questions so they are happy with what they're saying.
Okay. Jamie, you said something. Do you want to comment on it? Yeah, wait for the mic. Okay.
I was just saying that it doesn't follow. It doesn't necessarily follow that.
Explain why.
Therefore, naturalism must be true.
Why does it not follow?
Well, I would ask, how does it follow? How does it follow that that's the case? Because you can measure something in a reliable way here, why does that mean that naturalism, that only natural processes exist, how does that follow that that's the case? Yeah, you're only measuring, on this side, you're only measuring natural processes, but how does that follow that that's the only thing that can be true?
Right. And what if natural science, what if the data from natural science leads you to a supernatural conclusion?
And then what do we mean, Lou, when you come, that's number three, right?
Yeah.
Natural science is the most reliable way to learn about the world. To learn what about the world? How about learning the meaning of something? Dean spoke earlier about you can have all of these scientific data, but what do they mean? Meaning is a thing you know. So meaning, purpose, how about all the different things that we do? Michael over here had spoken about art. What do we know about the world when we do art that we don't know the world, that science has nothing to teach us? What do we know about the interactions of human beings that science has nothing to teach us about? What does science do that teaches us about whether we ought to love someone? Is that, can natural science provide a reliable answer to that? No, it's outside of the boundaries of science. It's not an empirical exercise. Notwithstanding that we have psychology, which has some empirical questions to it, and some empirical methods, but that even psychology doesn't answer the questions. It only tells us how the interactions typically work out. So does natural science reliably teach us to learn about everything in the world or only some things of the world? So if I were answering that question, you know, if the naturalist came up to me, I'd say, exactly what about the world are you going to tell me about? And tell me some of the things that you can't access. Because it's very reliable about physics. It's not very reliable about ethics.
Very good.
Okay, I'm trying to remember formal logic, but it seems like there should be two prepositions before you reach that conclusion of natural science's most reliable way to learn about the world. And partially because, as you just said, there's more parts of our world than our physical world, so to speak. I mean, there's, you know, mental, emotional, love, art, culture. You know, there's a lot to our world that are beyond our actual physical earth and universe. So I was thinking, it's almost an incomplete thought, but it reminds me of that fallacy of affirming the consequence, because I was thinking, oh, isn't the, I mean, I might be using that wrong, I hope not, but isn't, wouldn't that be a consequence? Natural science is the most logical, I mean, so, sorry, most reliable way to learn about the world. Wouldn't they, wouldn't that be a lot of assumptions before you have the two prepositions that would lead to making it
true? You and Jamie are both in the same camp there, and you're right, there is at least one silent premise that isn't there. And so we do have to sort of be intellectually charitable and put that in there. And there may be more, but if I were, let's just say, being as intellectually charitable as we can, if I were the naturalist, I would say, natural science is the most reliable way to learn about the world. And the way, the reason that it is because, is that we use methodological naturalism to acquire the knowledge. And there's no better way than methodological naturalism to acquire knowledge about the natural world. Therefore, naturalism must be true. If science is, and science is reliable, and science is a reliable way, pardon me, they're making a stronger claim, the most reliable way to learn about the world. So it's not invalid. That's actually a valid argument if you include all the premises I just stuck in there, which are tacit, but they're, I think they're, this is a legitimate argument, and our answer to it can be just as legitimate in the sense that we just tell them there are things in the natural world in which we live, particularly in human interactions, that are inaccessible to empirical science. So you cannot have a reliable empirical science of certain things like ethics and human interactions and other kinds of knowledge that have nothing to do with empirical, the empirical testing.
So then for a naturalist to say that, well, sometime in the future we will be able to explain things like ethics and beauty and love and consciousness from a naturalistic standpoint is a naturalism of the gaps, an unwarranted argument.
It's wishful thinking, yes. And it's wishful thinking in the sophisticated, fallacious way, in that it's, there is no, in principle, way of showing that it's true. You're making a prediction that you have no principled way, no direction or methodology to grant, to warrant that claim.
Right.
So it is, by definition, wishful thinking.
Good.
Does that make sense? Got two head nods. I'm doing good.
That means those guys are awake. Well, we got 5 minutes left. Do we want to take another one, Mark, or do you want to try to wrap it up? Or
I think we should wrap it up because we get into the next one, and we're going to have way too much fun with that one.
Then I'm going to give them the next one.
Don't do it.
No?
No. They won't tune in next week.
All right.
How... our advertisers will not want us to do that. All right, go ahead.
All right. All
right, I don't want to get
killed.
This
is maybe the best one, and you guys are going to need to think about it, all right? Believing in supernaturalism is the same as believing in magic.
He did it.
I did it. I did it, Mark. Okay, but I'm taking it off now.
All right, thank you.
There. I've got to go back.
Right. It's a secret. They'll never know.
So I want to reword something I said earlier because I thought I explained it well, but I don't think I explained it very well. I'm going to go back to what I said about an argument that you can all know and that you can all state. A naturalist will say that the very first thing in the universe is matter, mindless matter. All right? A theist believes that the very first thing, the source of all other things in the universe, is a mind. Namely God. So the question to ask is, given the way the universe looks, with all these things that look designed, which makes more sense? Does mind, the existence of mind and consciousness in the world, more naturally come from matter? Or does matter look more like it comes from a mind? What's the original source? And it sure looks like the way the universe is was thought through designed, intentional, purposeful, and that's better explained by the first source being a mind rather than the first source being mindless matter. Does that make sense? Argue that. Puts them a little on the defensive. I think it makes sense. What precedes what? What's best explained by what? Does that work? How would you like to close us in prayer?
I would love to do that.
Thank you.
Okay, let's pray. Lord, your thoughts are higher than our thoughts. Your ways are not our ways, but much higher than ours. We thank you, Lord, that you allow us to explore this world and all of the magnificence that you've created. You are a most beautiful God, a most loving God. And we thank you for that you've given us minds to look into this. Please, Lord, give us wisdom now to make use of it in a way that glorifies you. And we thank you that Jesus Christ came to die and to rise again to give us the hope of an eternal life in you that started today. Thank you, Lord. Bless your name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, everyone.
Good job.